Welcome everyone to Sunstone Session 321, The Iroquois as Lamanite, an argument for a contemporary reading of the Book of Mormon. You've heard this warning before several times if you've been here very long, but please turn off your cell phone right now if you haven't already done so. What else do I need to tell you about that? I think that's all I need to warn you about. We have two speakers today. John Larson will be presenting a paper, and then we'll have the respond. John has an MBA from Weber State University and a BA in linguistics from BYU. He's a host of the Mormon Expression podcast, executive director of the Whitefields Education Foundation, and is board chairman for the Post-Mormon Foundation. John lives in Lehi, Utah, with his wife, Silpha, and their two children. He works in software process engineering. And the respondent to the paper is Christopher Smith, who has an MA in Christian history from Wheaton College and is enrolled in a PhD program in North American religions at Claremont Graduate University. His research is about contacts between Mormons and American Indians, and that's going to be for his dissertation. So, go ahead, John.
All right, thanks. I'm set up to stand over here, so I'm going to hold the mic. This is sort of a little bit mistitled as I went through it. I started the presentation when I picked up on some of the consistencies between the Iroquois, especially in the 19th century. And this was doing that yesterday, too.
Yeah, maybe you should get the stand. It doesn't seem to do it with the stand.
And the Book of Mormon. But the issue is it's not just the Lamanites, it's also the Nephites, and we'll go through that also. In 1834, I mean, everyone knows about this experience, where when they were on Zion's camp, and they were on top of a mound or a hill, and they start kicking in the dirt, and found the skeleton of an apparently dead Indian that had an arrowhead, either that had been on the Indian's body or had been the cause of death, because it was intermixed with the bones. And Joseph Smith went on to say that this was the great warrior Zelph. But what's really interesting is he says that the warrior Zelph was under the prophet Onodamus. And it's something that, you know, I've known about and made fun of for a lot of years. But it was only a couple years ago that I realized that Onodamus means something. The Onodamus were one of the five nations of Iroquois. And it was actually the county name of the county that was right next to where Joseph Smith lived. So here you have an instance where Joseph Smith is pulling on something that we can connect in reality to something in the American continent at the time. So there are several models out there. We're going to talk about them a little bit. But obviously, Joseph Smith was influenced by everything that was happening around him, just like we all are. We all observe things. We go to school. We hear stories. We see things around, and we want to give interpretation of those things. And those things influence the way we look at and see the world. Skilled linguists can take a book, for example, and just by analyzing language usage, they can pinpoint time and place. And likely as computer programs get much better at this, we'll be able to say, oh, this was written at this time in this place. Now, obviously, that doesn't necessarily bode poorly for the Book of Mormon, because we say Joseph Smith translated it into English, so he would have used the English that he was aware of. But there can also be other elements, both cultural and linguistic and fragments of just all sort of things that can influence whatever he's doing that give a hint. And we see this all the time in literature where anachronisms creep in, where somebody might not understand something or realize that people did things differently. And it can be just simple as word. Like if I use the word, he stoked the furnace, you have a pretty good idea of when, because we use the word furnace and you know, not stove or whatever, and these words stoke, we can kind of narrow that sort of thing down to a particular instance in time where we know the individual would be using that wording. So the Book of Mormon, there's been many who argue that it's a 19th century work in totality, not just a 19th century translation, and we're not going to do a survey of all that sort of thing, but I do believe that one of the things we have to do is we have to take the law of parsimony, Occam's razor, to the book, and use that sort of as a base case to say the book is likely written by Joseph or by others who are his contemporaries, and then argue for a more miraculous or a more off-the-path argument. So as we go through this presentation, I think one of the objections by the faithful would be that well, you know, just because there's parallels between the Iroquois of the time and the thought pattern of the time doesn't mean it isn't ancient. I grant that, but we see lots of parallels, and as I was doing this research, I started finding more and more and more, and we're going to have to, you know, cram them in tightly just to get them in this half hour. So I do believe that that is sort of the base case that we need to argue for. We would first have to argue that Joseph Smith is writing the book from his experience, and then the case that it might be from an external perspective would be the next thing to follow on. All right, let's talk first about the historical background from a European point of view. There is a long, long history of European and Indian interaction before we sort of even become aware of it. And, you know, the best way to think about this is Columbus landed in 1492. You take that amount of time to the Revolution, 1776, and the Revolution to our day, there's more time between the first contact and the Revolution in terms of interaction between the colonists and the natives than there is, has been since. And we tend to underestimate that. As a matter of fact, in his book, Lila, by Robert Piercy, he makes a compelling argument that we both sort of acknowledge our interaction with the natives, with the Native Americans and the Indians, because you see place names all over the place. You can't escape them. I mean, it's not just here in Utah we have all these names. If you go back east, especially to this territory, just everything, roads, place names, and that kind of contact doesn't come casually. That means there had to be enough social interaction between the folks all the time that they actually absorbed those names. And Piercy argues that there's a lot of cultural interaction that happened, and we can actually see a lot of historical evidence for this. So what happened when the first waves of colonists, especially in the early part of the 17th century, came to the New World, is they brought with them chiefly disease. And scholars estimate the first wave, like first contact, oftentimes they would come in, they would set up camp, they would go back, and they would come back the next year, and it would be blank. There are all these names in the East, like Clearfield, and Field This, and Field That. The fields weren't naturally cleared. They had been cleared. And what happened is that in the first few years, scholars estimate as many as 50% of the native populations died off. And in the subsequent years, approaching 90 to 95%. And those numbers diminished as we moved inland, but especially the coastal Indians in the fur trading area where we're interested up in the northeast part of the United States were just absolutely decimated. And the tribes that were on the coast were just wiped out completely. And then, like the Mohicans, as we move in a little bit further, they experienced further that. And then we get to the Iroquois, which are in sort of the Finger Lake region. We'll look at that a little bit more. They didn't have as much devastation, but there's still estimation that the population was down by as much as 80%. So there was this huge devastation. Why this is important is these cultures were much more sophisticated than our traditional view of Indians give them for. So there were villages, there were roads, there were farming, there was all sorts of implementation. And so the first wave of settlers ran into it. As a matter of fact, many of you probably know this, Jamestown folks liked to dig Indian graves to pull corn up to live on, because they would bury Indians with corn for whatever ceremonial reason. And they would eat it. So they didn't have a lot of respect for the kind of respect for ruins and for archaeological discovery that we have now. And they would see these things and they would just tear them down and build a tower or whatever. So it didn't take very long, like a few hundred years, before there became this confusion with the natives, the savages that were out in the woods. And this apparent sophisticated culture that they were sitting on top of, that they would dig through burial sites and find arms and armor and things like that we'll go into. There was also a great deal of cultural adaptation, and we'll see some images of that. So, for example, for the Iroquois, by the 18th century, the mid-1700s, they completely adopted cotton clothing as their native mode of dress. And they completely adopted the rifle and other elements they'd gotten, copper and iron, that they would trade. And there have been hundreds of years of that trade, so that the culture actually shifted from what archaeologists now can say, we know that this tribe did not have any copper production, and the copper they got was from trade, and we can tell that through our archaeological digging. Okay, so the settlement pattern in the United States was driven economically, and the northeast section of the United States was driven by the fur trade. There was a lot of fur, and fur is a lucrative trade into Europe. And for close to 200 years, the beaver wars in this whole region raged between different tribes and fueled by different European colonial powers that pushed the conflict and pushed this sort of unending war and sort of savagery that was escalated into control the fur trade routes. And we're not going to go into the details of that, but it's really important to know that it dominated the 17th century and was pretty well over by the middle of the 18th century, in the mid-1700s, and the Europeans obviously had vanquished the traditional Indian homelands, the traditional Indian culture, and there was complete and utter dominance in the area. So there's my picture. You know that by the 17th century, you know you had full cultural adoption of the trade paradigms. Now, what's important here is that those coming along later, 19th century, would not necessarily realize that cotton blankets and all that stuff, because they'd been around for hundreds of years, literally hundreds of years, the Indians had adopted that. And they wouldn't necessarily realize that this was not, and the Indians themselves would not necessarily realize that this was a fairly recent thing that came after the colonialization. They would just say, you know, we can dig back hundreds of years and find this stuff. We can find, you know, copper and that was traded in as pots from the European continent in the 1600s, and it had been around for literally hundreds of years. Okay, so for the Iroquois in particular, there were the five nations, and they occupied the area that we all recognize from the maps in our scripture. So the Mohican territory was over here to the coast, but this area down right below Lake Ontario was dominated by the Iroquois. And during the 17th and 18th century, the Iroquois were a military powerhouse. They became literally the image of Indian, the savage Indian that Americans have had for hundreds of years was really influenced by these folks. And we'll talk about some of those elements. And these are the five nations. Interestingly enough, Oneida also appears in the Book of Mormon. I believe in Alma 47:13, they reference the town of Oneida. And Onondagas, of course, like we said at the beginning, was referenced by Joseph Smith when he was talking about the Zelph. So Joseph Smith was right at ground zero in terms of the Iroquois nation. This map I took off of LDS, so I just want to overlay, you know, Palmyra, Hill Cumorah, Manchester, all that sort of stuff. So you can see the area where we're looking at. Now, the Iroquois had a pattern of basically three settlements. The first were towns. And the Iroquois, one author I read, said that they, outside of Europe, they had the largest settlement practice in the New World. A lot of their towns were as high as 2,000 people. And in an era before, like indoor plumbing and that sort of stuff, that's a huge cultural advancement. It's very difficult to get that many human beings living in close contact. And these cities were oftentimes described as castles by the Europeans. So Seneca Castle, the site down there we'll talk about in a second, is one of those, and it's still called Seneca Castle today, although it's just kind of a crappy intersection in the middle of upstate New York now. So the first one was the town, so that's where the center of the village was. Then there were villages, there were small outposts. So you might, when you're doing sort of dry farming and you don't have really sophisticated irrigation, you might have to spread out quite a bit. And it was a common practice for the Iroquois men to go on sort of these vigils where they would go, you know, 50, 100 miles away to hunt these grounds or do this other stuff. The third village arrangement they had is fishing villages, and they didn't occupy them permanently. So the main highway there was actually a thoroughfare for the Iroquois across Iroquois. And these are two main villages. The Tower of Peace right there was the actual signing village where the Declaration of Peace ending the Beaver Wars was signed. So these two villages were probably, these two red points here, were probably, you know, around 1,000 to 1,000 Indians living. They would have been walking back and forth and up to the lake for their fishing villages and just owned this whole territory. So literally tens of thousands of Iroquois prior to the time of Joseph Smith, 17th century, 16th century, would have occupied this territory. Just for a matter of scale, from the Smith farmhouse, both of those are less than 20 miles away. This map was written in 1879. It's a map of the mission sites, and you can see following the same pattern. The Smith home is right up in here. So they would have built the missions right near the major settlements. And you can see that thoroughfare, those dotted lines indicating the roads and areas of travel. This is a map from 1771, the same sort of thing. You can see this crisscross of roads. You can see the villages, the fishing villages up on this on the side, and the major areas. Here's the two that I identified. Well, the one is right here, the one's right here. There's another major one that's right there south of Rochester. Now the problem is, I mentioned briefly that there was not really a cultural respect for archaeological sites. So these sites are just basically decimated. There's very little archaeological value in those main sites. Because we just built, we would literally come in and just build our towns right on top of the previous towns, and like I said, use the material, the bricks, the rocks to, you know, make a well or whatever. There was very little respect. So it's difficult to find artifacts that today that are meaningful. But for somebody in the 19th century, somebody who was, say, digging for gold quite a bit, this place would have been just rich with archaeological discoveries. And because the burial practice of burying individuals with metal or with other war implements, you would find those, and you would have this attitude of here's somebody who's buried or laying in the ground, and they're in full armor, they have a chest plate, they have a sword or whatever. You might start drawing conclusions about what happened in this place. Now there are two models that are out there right now. The Mesoamerican model, of course, we're all familiar with. That's the traditional sort of LDS-sponsored view. If you go to farms and other LDS outlets, they'll talk in great detail about trying to place all the sites down there in Mesoamerica. There's been a rise of, under Rodney Meldrum, of this new Heartland sort of view, and they're actually using some of the same evidence that I'm using here, but they still argue for a big, wide span, and they have very little respect for, like, what archaeologists say things are. You know, they might find something and say it's that or the other. So what I'm basically arguing is that Joseph Smith was influenced based on what he saw, what he dug out of the ground, what he would hear. He was just in ground zero, like I said, of all of this interaction with the Iroquois and the rich history, because he knew people who had been involved in Indian wars. And I can see that personally. I had a grandfather who died, or great-grandfather, and he died about 20 years ago. When I was 10 or 12, he was like 90. But he would just go on and on and on about the Indian wars they fought, like in San Pete County. So Joseph Smith was not that removed from people who had actually been involved in these battles, these pitched battles with the Iroquois. But by the time Joseph Smith was around, you know, they'd mostly moved down into the Ohio, and they weren't a threat. That narrative of the savage attacking the white settlements from the forest would have still been live and active, and there would have still been people putting around. You know, it's very likely that Joseph Smith ran into natives during his sojourn up in the area. Okay, so let's get to the meat of the matter. There are a lot of passages in the Book of Mormon, and what's interesting is they span the entire Book of Mormon. There is a 1,000-year period, but the description, the cultural description of the people is very consistent. If you know anything about cultures, that's extremely odd. If you go to most Native American archaeological sites in the United States today, they'll track and say, they did this for these 75 years, then 100 years they did this, and they can pinpoint, and they can validate with carbon dating and other things. The Book of Mormon has a 1,000-year consistency, and a lot of the elements that we see that we can trace to Iroquois culture, Iroquois practice, get distributed among both the Lamanites and the Nephites. But first, let's look at these descriptions. And, you know, the descriptions are, they're savages, they're bloodthirsty, they're lazy, they're indolent, they live in the woods, they shave their heads, they paint themselves red, they wear lambskin, they go around mostly naked, They carry clubs and all that sort of stuff. Here's a couple more. Like I said, I didn't try to grab all of the scriptural references. I'm going to show you some. These paintings are from the late 19th century, but they show a prototypical Iroquois warrior. You'll notice that the head's shaved. The Iroquois painted their faces red when they were going into battle, or sometimes black. And in the Book of Mormon, it's sometimes identified as blood. The paint was not obviously blood, but you know it would give that sort of fearful appearance to any person you were going up against. You'll notice that we do have fabric here, but especially when Iroquois went into battle, they would strip themselves down naked, or just a loincloth. They wouldn't do that all the time, but it was a fearful battle centric dress. These are contemporary paintings. These three from the 18th century. So you can still see that there's the headpiece that's pretty common, the shorn head, the painting of the face red. All right. So another common element. We talk about is the forts, right? In Book of Mormon, they describe very, very in detail the forts that they give them to the Nephites would build. And they would say they'd build the big pickets up, and they'd put ditches down in front, and then they'd have platforms they could throw things down on. This is actually a description of an Iroquois village or an Iroquois fort. These pictures are a little bit hard to see, but here you can see one with the palisades around. The ditches, and I'll show you another picture, were actually built oftentimes near a lake. Because if you live in a wooden palisade, your enemy's probably going to try to light you on fire. So, but when Joseph Smith or whoever would see these ruins, if you go to 17th century descriptions of them, they describe the ditches. But in ruins, you wouldn't necessarily see the water. You would just see the ditch. And then you would see the coming up to the other side. So these are all contemporary artist rendering of Iroquois forts. And now when you buy the little set to play soldiers, it always has the cavalry with the fort. Of course, the cavalry did build forts, but we learned some of this model from the natives who were there already. And here's another one. This shows a raid where they're building the tower, but you can see clearly the ditches that were there to keep the fires down. Okay, one of the things in the Book of Mormon is the possession of land, which is this, and I sort of hinted at this a few minutes ago, that there were these sophisticated Nephites who built cities and built walls and had all this sort of stuff, and then the Lamanites were jealous of that, but indolent and lazy. And would sit out in the woods, and then they would chase the Nephites out and then possess their cities. So I think this is a clear retelling of sort of a prejudicial New Englander view of what had happened. Because, like I said in the beginning, prior to the colonial settlement, the Indian settlements were quite sophisticated. But by the middle of the 19th century, the Indians had all been blown off these lands, so they would look around and see these ruins and see this evidence of a great civilization. They say, those savages out there cannot be responsible for this. And not only that, they're trying to come back in and take this, which doesn't belong to them. Now, obviously, we know now, they were trying to take back or trying to come back into their ancestral home. But that was not clear to the colonialists settling into Indian territory like they were doing in Upper State New York. So there's this narrative that's to try to explain this discrepancy. And we do this all the time when we're prejudicial and we see a people, then we say, oh, they're stupid, they're lazy or whatever. And then we see some sort of significance, oh, that must have been that they were on welfare or they had some sort that they'd given to them. It's this common human element to say, this person who I don't like can't be responsible for this goodness. There must be something else that explains it. And it's the same sort of story. Thieving and murdering. What's really interesting is there are some real cultural elements here among the Iroquois. One of the cultural elements was the society was more egalitarian. They didn't have kings. They didn't have leaders. So you had what you had. You were able to possess what you needed. But anything that you had in excess was seen as communal property. So if you had a hammer that you left lying around and you weren't using it, it was perfectly okay to just come up and take it, because anything that wasn't yours specifically was part of the communal thing. There was also this element, which we don't have time to go into here. The sex dynamic among the Iroquois is fascinating, but men could not go to war. Men were the warriors, but women had to declare war. And there was this element among the Indian tribes of reciprocity. And if one tribal village came up and attacked another one and, say, killed three men, then the women of the victim tribe could declare war. And they would ask for a replacement. So what they would do is they would go back to the other tribe, and they would raid, and they would take three women and their children to replace the families. So there was a cultural element of these raids for specifically women and children on the idea that you destroyed one of our families, we have the right to do that. And it was an acknowledged and sort of understood practice. The problem is when the Indians came in contact with the white settlers, and then they would go and kill six Indians. Then they would go into the white settlement, and then they would take six women. Of course, the Europeans didn't look very kindly on this at all. What's really interesting, when it's outside the scope of this, but oftentimes, if you read the stories, the European women usually didn't want to go back. And that is one story I know of where the woman escaped four times. I kept moving here. Weaponry. There is a lot of weaponry described in the Book of Mormon. Interestingly enough, some of them that you might not think were actually Iroquois weapons. The Iroquois did employ spears. So the spear appears all over. Once again, Joseph Smith, gold digging around in the dirt, would have no trouble finding elements of these. There's some interesting ones that I want to point out. One is a sword. I was looking at some 16th century registers of trade, and they would trade quite a few swords. That it was something that in the early days the Indians, so you don't see them presented in paintings, but it was a huge trade element during the 16th century. And an iron sword or a steel sword sticks around for quite a while. So while we have this thing we don't even associate with the Iroquois or the Indians today, there's clear archaeological evidence that they have found them, and then we have these trade registers. So even something as simple as a sword, we have traceability to that. One of the weapons that appears in the Book of Mormon that gets made fun of a lot is a scimitar. It's spelled this way. If you look at the old spelling of this, one of the definitions of this is about a 10-inch curved blade. Now, we think of the blades like the Arabians would use on their horses, but it really sort of the word indicates a curved blade. This thing on the left, you've probably all seen before. It's a traditional Iroquois bludgeon. It's kind of a mace. That they would hit people with. Notice the curve to it. And you also see this is generally called today a gunstock mace or whatever. And you see the blade. It's kind of hard to see. There's a blade sticking out. These are thin. And it's very common in 18th and 17th century art of the Iroquois to show them with this. But if you're looking at a woodcut in a book in the 19th century, it's not going to be necessarily clear that thing's made of wood, right? And it's curved, and it's the right size, and it's really common in the artistic depiction of the Iroquois to show them holding that thing. So we have weapons and implements that are used by the Iroquois from the time that match the description of Joseph Smith, even though they seem time out of place for us. They seem like, why would he put the scimitar in? But there's clearly an Iroquois implement that matches that general description. Scalping, it's almost comical to admit that scalping exists in the Book of Mormon, but it does. The Iroquois were big on scalping, actually, and the common description of the villages is, you know, I said they were the palisade that would house 1,000 to 2,000 people. They would generally carve two heads, one on either side of the front gate to the palisade, and they would then put the scalps of their enemies there as sort of a fearful tactic. So scalping was a Iroquois practice. My understanding is it was first exploited by the French, who would pay the Mohawks and the Iroquois for English scalps. But it was a long traditional activity of humiliating, killing an alternative, an opponent warrior. We mentioned raiding for women. It actually does appear. There's Mosiah chapter 20. I want to talk a little bit about the mounds. I'm not here to lecture about possible theories for the Book of Mormon, but the Mound Builder Society, which was really all throughout the Ohio, And did creep up into this area a little bit, was extremely noticeable because they built great big mounds. Some of them had ceremonial purposes, like they were leveled out, and obviously something happened there. Others were burial mounds. Oops, sorry. And in these burial mounds, what you would see is year after year, generation after generation, new dead would be buried in the mound. So if you dug down into the mound, what you would find is, you know, warrior after warrior after warrior after warrior. What seemed like a great big pile of dead people had been left here and buried. Obviously, we know now that these were actual burial sites, but the interpretation might be, you go to any of these hills and start digging, you're going to find swords, you're going to find arrows, you're going to find armor, you know, that was traded for in war ceremonial, made from pots or whatever. You're going to find all these implements, and it appears that there have been these great, big, huge battles because of these piles of the dead that would be found there, which we can easily explain today based on the archaeological evidence. All right, so I wanted to go through some quick ones. There's obviously a lot more detail behind this. There are other things that appear in there that are actually food for thought. For example, in Helaman we talk about the people who went way north started building houses of cement. Well, you can find contemporary accounts. Matter of fact, I found one in the Evening and Morning Star talking about the Pueblos that were being found in the southwest that describe it as being made of cement, the adobe, because, you know, they didn't quite understand what they were seeing. So I think there's a lot of these elements that can really be accounted for if you take the view of saying, looking at the way people would have understood the archaeology in the 19th century, looking at what they had access to, what they could see, and how they would impose a description of it. And you see a very clear picture emerge of the culture and practice of the Iroquois as Joseph Smith would know it, being right there in Ground Zero, and also the archaeological evidence that he would self-interpret as he dug around in the ground like he did. I mean, that was his occupation. He was a ground digger. There's my basic presentation. Chris?
5 minutes.
All right.
Okay. Are you done? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
John's given us a very nice presentation here. I love the PowerPoint and found a lot of really interesting data. I want to start out by just talking about the importance of this topic for understanding Mormonism. The Book of Mormon on the title page addresses itself primarily to the Lamanites and only secondarily to the Gentiles and the Jews. In 1831, Joseph Smith sends Oliver Cowdery, Parley Pratt, off as missionaries to the Indians of Kansas. Initially, when they're sent out, they're also instructed to select a site for building Zion among the Lamanites. Now, later, the revelation gets modified to read on the borders by the Lamanites, but initially it's among the Lamanites, and it's only after they get kicked off the Indian reservation that the revelation gets changed. And they end up selecting a site within Missouri. So it seems to have been the intention originally to build the New Jerusalem inside Indian territory, outside the boundaries of the United States of America. And it was to be a city of refuge, so when the United States was destroyed, the Mormons would then go take refuge outside the United States borders. In 1831, we get... in Kirtland, these revivals, we get these wonderful stories of people speaking in Indian tongues, people acting out Indian gestures, people miming the baptism of Indians, people miming preaching to Indians. So Indians initially are a central part of Mormon devotion, and it's not only the mission to convert the Indians, but it's also, Indians play this apocalyptic role in early Mormon theology. The Book of Mormon talks about the Indians going like a roaring lion and tearing and destroying the Gentiles who refuse to repent. So there's this apocalyptic vision of the Indians being God's tool to smite the Gentiles in the last days. When the Mormons get kicked off the reservation in 1831. The Indian aspect of Mormonism seems to get subordinated for a few years, but there's a revival of it in Nauvoo. When the Mormons are driven out of Missouri, they again build their new city on the borders by the Lamanites. They build it on the edge of Illinois, right across the river from Indian territory. In fact, Nauvoo is built on the site of an Indian village. Then there are numerous Indian delegations who come and visit Joseph Smith at Nauvoo, some of whom had been residents in that village just a few years before they were removed by the federal Indian policy, and then Nauvoo was subsequently built on the site. Some of the Indians propose a military alliance with the Mormons against the United States, which Joseph Smith refuses. Running for president at the time probably wouldn't have been good for PR. So this is a very important aspect of early Mormonism, and so I commend you, John, for bringing this to our attention. Joseph Smith did have a number of things in his early life that seemed to have suggested to him more like Indian-themed topics. So John highlighted the treasure digging in Indian mounds. There were, I think, one scholar has found that there were 13 burial mounds within just a few miles of where Joseph Smith lived. Cumorah seems to have been regarded as an Indian burial mound. So they're digging for Indian artifacts. If you believe that the Book of Mormon peoples are the ancestors of the Indians, then you could regard the Book of Mormon plates themselves as an Indian artifact. We also have other stories of Joseph Smith encountering Indian treasure guardians, the spirits of departed Indians who were guarding artifacts that he was digging for. On one occasion, he seems to look into his stone and he sees an old Indian king sitting in a cave underneath the ground. So in addition to questing for Indian artifacts, John mentioned that Joseph Smith was not far removed from the French and Indian War, War of 1812, in which Indians figured prominently. And he's exactly right about that. I believe it's Lucy Matt Smith who reports a family tradition of Solomon Mack, in which he had a close encounter with an Indian and almost got killed. I believe it was during the French and Indian War. And he uses the same rhetoric of describing the Indians as bloodthirsty that we find in the Book of Mormon to describe the Lamanites. So this seems to be something that may have provided material, imaginative material in the Book of Mormon narrative. With regard to the Onondagas thing, I think that that really is potentially the ace in the hole that can support John's argument. I mean, Joseph Smith, in Mormon scriptures, there's a repeating motif of eponymous founders, eponymous meaning the tribe or the group is named after the founder, right? So Nephites are named after Nephi, Lamanites are named after Laman, Zoramites, the Egyptians are named after Egyptus. So to have an ancient prophet named Onondagas suggests perhaps that he is the eponymous founder of the Onondaga tribe in much the same way. So I do think that you are correct. I think that when Joseph Smith is talking about the Lamanites, he to a large degree has the Iroquois in mind. And there are some really good scholars who have denied that there's Indian stuff in the Book of Mormon, who've, you know, interpreted the Book of Mormon as almost exclusively describing the Nephites and Lamanites in Hebraic terms, and sort of deny that there's this Indian imagery in there. And I think to a large part that's probably the result of watching too many spaghetti westerns and not having enough information about the specific cultures of this region and the stereotypes and so forth that existed in the minds of 19th century Americans. I mean, if you're looking for 21st century stereotypes of Indians, in the Book of Mormon, you're going to miss some things that would have existed in the culture of Joseph Smith, some stereotypes that would have existed in his culture. I still think that there are some questions as to how much Joseph really knew. With regard to fortifications, there certainly was talk of fortifications. The mound builder myth being a prominent example of speculation about who built these fortifications that we find all over the country, who built these massive mounds, right? But unfortunately, we don't have direct links between Joseph Smith and these mound builder myths. We don't know like how much detail he may have encountered. I feel fairly confident that he had encountered these myths. We do have one source that suggests that the treasure diggers of the region had learned some of this from Mordecai Noah, who was a Jewish diplomat who was trying to construct a Jewish Zion in the region. And he invited the Indians to come and join the Jews because the Indians were supposed to be descendants of the Jews. And so that seems to have been sort of percolating in the neighborhood, and I believe there was even an article on that in the local newspaper in Palmyra. So Joseph Smith may have encountered that. But, you know, as far as like how many of the specifics he knew, it's not entirely clear. And some of the things in the Book of Mormon appear to reflect perhaps anachronistic ideas about Indians, like, for instance, the idea that the Indians could come and wipe out the Gentiles by this time is not really realistic. But given the history of warring with Indians, it may have seemed more plausible to Joseph Smith if he didn't have a lot of firsthand knowledge of Indians. There were Indians in New York still, but it was just a few small communities. To a large degree, they had already been removed from those lands and pushed west. So when Joseph Smith sends out his first missionaries, there's a question of why not go to the Indians who are still there? Why do they go west? Maybe they don't even know about the Indians who are still there. I mean, there's Brothertown was, I think, 80 miles from Palmyra, so potentially Joseph Smith could have known about Brothertown. He may even have encountered some Indians from Brothertown, but we don't have good evidence of that. We don't have good evidence that he actually encountered a lot of Indians during his early life. So, you know, it's unclear how much of his knowledge is firsthand versus how much of it is based on rumor, how much of it is based on this local mythology, this treasure-digging lore, family lore, and so forth. There is an interesting... well, first of all, I'd like to add maybe one thing to your list here of parallels, which is cannibalism. The Book of Mormon makes a statement, I forget the exact words, but it's something like the Lamanites ate the hearts of their enemies in order to absorb their bravery, or something along those lines, which was an Iroquois ritual. They would perform ritual cannibalism, and by doing that, the enemies would be adopted into the tribe ritualistically as replacements for the fellow tribe members who have been killed in battle.
Yeah, it's pretty gross. They would ritualistically dismember the bodies and then digest them.
I've actually found one or two newspaper accounts that refer to something along the lines of absorbing bravery by through cannibalism. So this was not unknown to the whites of the day. How widely known it was, I don't know, but it seems specific enough that it's probably related. With regard to iron swords and armor, are you basing that just simply on reports of the time of discoveries of iron swords, or are there modern archaeologists who say that the Iroquois had iron swords?
From what my understanding, they're not very common, but more common is to find like the breastplates that are ornamental, that were often made of pot or potting brass and potting iron. So you would see that in burial sites more often. The swords were very rare, but there was evidence that, especially in the 1500s, they were traded for, but that fell off more for flintlock rifles.
I would wonder how many of those, like if the Indians did have swords, whether those were like borrowed from the Europeans. Because I haven't done a lot of reading on pre-Columbian Iroquois archaeology, but I would be sort of surprised if they had iron swords.
It's pretty clear there were no. For the Iroquois pre-Columbian, there was no. There was a very little trade with the Northeast to get some copper that they'd use in burial sites. But most of the metals that appear in the burial sites, 1600s, 1700s, came from European trade.
Okay.
And so the swords would not show up at all in archaeological sites prior to the beaver traders.
Okay. But these are being discovered in upstate New York, and people are sort of projecting them back onto pre-Columbian times.
Potentially, right? Yeah.
And coins also are discovered. Old world coins are often discovered in burial mounds and so forth, and people speculate that this is from an ancient civilization. So, you know, these sort of pseudo-archaeological finds are providing material for the imagination, more imagination as well, I think. I'll just end on this kind of a fun note. There's a tradition among the Iroquois, which was documented by Lori Taylor, that the followers of Handsome Lake, who was an Indian prophet around the time of Joseph Smith, gave Joseph Smith the idea to write the Book of Mormon. That these Indians met with Joseph Smith and told him about the book that their prophet had produced for their tribe, and how it had transformed their people and made them into better people and helped them work through all of the social problems that their tribe was facing. And they told Joseph Smith, you know, you should get a book too. So probably not a historically accurate story. It's probably just folklore, but it's intriguing. And I think it speaks to the kinship that exists between the Book of Mormon and the Iroquois. So, thank you.
And we have a few minutes for questions. I think probably we'll just have you restate the question, since we've only got one mic.
Okay.
Yeah, briefly, one thing that Chris hit on that I thought was interesting is our modern conceptualization of Indians from the movies, especially in the 50s, really has a lot more to do with like the Lakota, the Plains Indians. And it's really interesting that would be anachronistic for Joseph Smith to describe Indians like with full, you know, eagle feather headdresses and riding around on horses, which he doesn't. So it's interesting that today, if we think about the Indians, we have this sort of prejudicial view ourselves based on our historical interaction that he didn't have. So the book is very consistent, like I talked about in the very beginning, with what he would have thought about Indians and not what we would think about Indians today. Go ahead.
Great presentation. That's a lot of good food for thought. Thanks. Clifton, are you familiar with Clifton Jolly's map that he drew? And he's got various names that match things in the northern hemisphere and southern hemisphere. I think Onondagas is in there. Could you comment on that?
I did a little bit of research. My fear is that most of it is baloney. I don't think there is good evidence for a lot of what this is it's a map that shows the Northeast, and he has a lot of Book of Mormon names. Like he has Zarahemla on there and that sort of thing. I specifically look for references to Zarahemla. Can't find any on any map besides his. And you see some of the maps that I showed that were contemporary from the time. The Indian name places are sparse. And we sort of know where the sites are, and I think he has it sort of more densely populated than the place was. It is definitely something that would do further to look into. But like I point out, there are at least two instances, Oneida and Onondagas, that Joseph Smith comes up with. And I believe that there is a ripe area of research for taking some of the place names and doing some sort of play on it. There's a very consistency to the way Joseph Smith, or the writer of the Book of Mormon, comes up with names. And I there are some elements that are similar to some of the Indian place naming. But I think that map in particular is a stretch. Go ahead.
I appreciate your presentation. Again, I certainly read a lot of food for thought. One aspect, though, that I'm just curious for myself, you used the reference of Scimitar and showed, I believe, the Enos reference. there's kind of a conflict within the academy about the derivation of the origins of the etymology of these specific terms. I just wondered if you've done any research on that, because the term scimitar emerged, was introduced by Muhammad in 622 AD, which of course is 200 years after the Book of Mormon, and yet Joseph Smith has used it. I just searched and found 11 specific references where he uses the word scimitar in the context of the Book of Mormon narrative. Have you ever done any reference to the etymology of any of the terms that he is?
I looked a little bit, and it said the question is on the etymology of the reference scimitar, and the background given is that the first appearance of the word scimitar, or the archaeological evidence for scimitars appearing, actually occurs after the time frame of Joseph Smith, yeah, sort of during the Arabian expansion, right? The little bit of research I did into it, you know, the question is not what scimitar means to us or what it meant to people in the 8th century. What did it mean to Joseph Smith? And the interesting modern reference now for it being used is, of course, the cutlass that we all know, but it's also used by chefs. There's a 10-inch curved knife that that oftentimes chefs, kitchen folks, will call a scimitar. When I found that sparked an interest to see how old is that usage, because that might be something that Joseph Smith was more in line with, and that sort of more fits in line with these artistic depictions of Iroquois that show that sort of a weapon.
But the point being, of course, any weapon that has any kind of curve to it, that does not make it a scimitar. Your two examples from a material culture view, we really, wince a little bit at that. But you make a good point about how he uses the Book of Enos and so on.
Right. I think the bottom line response to the Book of Mormon usage, as looking at the Book of Mormon as a historical document, is there is no archaeological evidence for metallurgy, the type of metallurgy or coke furnaces it would take to create a blade that would be useful in the description, and there's no archaeological evidence of those pre-Columbian, of any type of iron or that sort of edged weapon.
Yeah. All right, thank you.
Go ahead.
This may be out of the area of your expertise, I don't know.
That never stopped me in the past.
Have you done any DNA testing on the Iroquois tribe?
The DNA to look for what markers? Rodney Meldrum and the Meldrumites. As a matter of fact, one of their books, I think.
So he is
the
one
that's
the DNA evidence?
Yeah, that's
right. There's another book where they actually have DNA in the title. And so they're arguing for some markers, and I get convoluted and lost in those arguments. There are folks who are looking for specific DNA markers, and I, if anybody's familiar with the work, they go through a lot of it. It's not impressive to some, to others it is, but they've looked at it. The best that I can understand is the native populations that came from the New World, that are in the New World, either in the 3 or 5 waves of invasion, came across the Bering Strait, and are genetically related to people of
Central
Asian descent.
Asian.
Yeah, Central Asian descent. That's my understanding. Go ahead.
Do you have any idea where Joseph Smith got the name Zelf, or did he just pull that out of his hat?
People get hung up on whether Joseph Smith was telling the truth or not all the time. You got to give the guy credit, one way or the other. He was a creative fella, and he was really smart. Because that instance hit at a time when they were down, and here they are. They're looking at the bones of this connection. You know, this is the altar that Adam prayed at, and this is the Garden of Eden. It's just right at exactly the right time, whether it be from divine inspiration or just from the man's genius. You have to admire that tenacity. It's impressive.
What are your further plans for this research?
I had to go through it really quick here because of the time limitation, but just the parallels. And, I sort of say this at the beginning. Like Chris was saying, it's really hard to establish. It's impossible to establish what Joseph Smith knew, what he read, what he'd encountered. But when you start seeing a lot of roads, a lot of paths going to the same point, then you have something there. So I would like to, I'm not going to commit to, I'd like to do further research and get some of the details and some of the details on the battle plan, like the archaeological sites that Chris referenced and I referenced, and see what is around there. So I think there's a lot more to be done there, and look for some of that cultural consistency, because we really just had to do a quick survey here. Yes, sir.
I am on the same theoretical page with you as far as seeing 19th century conceptions of Native Americans in the Book of Mormon, and I don't personally currently believe in the historical claims of the Book of Mormon, but I'm curious if you would comment on how we get these really interesting parts into the very complicated whole that is the Book of Mormon as a narrative.
So the question is, there's these parts that we're talking about influence, but then you have this complex Book of Mormon. And so the question is, how do we explain it in totality, or what?
Just your theory on how we go from these very convincing theories of the parts to how a young boy like Joseph Smith produced this perfect.
Okay, so how do we go from these parts to the whole of the Book of Mormon? And that's, a lot of people look at it in totality and say, you know, how could this happen? My thing is, I don't really know. Personally, I don't see it. I see that there have been better books written. So the idea that this young man couldn't have written the book, to be a little bit of a stretch. I think it's several standard deviations outside of normal human behavior. But that doesn't make us look at something and say that, you know, the Odyssey or the Iliad is such a great work that it couldn't possibly be written by a human being. I don't think most of us in this room would make that stretch. But, you know, for example, I tend to reject the theory, like the Spalding theories, personally, that Rigdon and those guys had, because I personally think Rigdon was too much of an egomaniac to give his manuscript to anybody else. But I can't account for all the Campbellite theology that shows up in the book, because to me that's the biggest argument against Joseph Smith as an author, because I don't see evidence that Joseph Smith would have been as versed in Campbellite theology that shows up all over in that book. But Cowdery was there, you know, if we accept the standard description, Cowdery was there. We know they kept mucking with the book. There was a research done 2 or 3 years ago where they took the printer's copies of the Book of Mormon, the ones we have in existence, and they would go and change the typeset mid printing. Until the printing, they didn't stop messing with the book. So first editions are different because they would change them the mid stride. So they kept playing with it the whole time. But the bottom line for me is, it's clearly based on this evidence. It's clearly a 19th century work. And to me, there's very little evidence of ancient Mesoamerica in there, scant to none. Yes, sir?
John, you talk about the Campbellite theology. Walter Scott, who was the big Campbellite evangelist, was very active in the Palmyra area in 1825. So there could be a possible connection.
Right, yeah, the comment is that Walter Scott was active up in the area, and Campbellite theology was obviously around, and the Campbellites were riffing on ideas that were current in the time anyway. You know, ideas that, for Mormons, we look at something like baptism for remission of sins, which is a really big concept in the 19th century, like no one cares today. But so you see these things that are clearly there. Yeah, I Joseph Smith, and I mean this in the most endearing way, was a magpie. And we see evidence later in his life where he gives extemporaneous talks and quote huge sections of the Bible. The man very well could have been, had a photographic memory. Either way, he had a very keen mind for theology and for religion, and he was able to shape that into whatever shape he sort of needed at the time. So for me, it's well within the realm of him to produce the book. Frankly, I'm not that impressed with it.
Okay. Say one.
Chris, please.
Yeah, and then we ought to end up because it's okay.
I just want to say in closing that I don't think it's absolutely necessary to believe that the Book of Mormon is exclusively a 19th century text to accept the argument that John has presented. Blake Osler has presented this wonderful expansion theory where he says that the Book of Mormon is an ancient book, but that Joseph Smith, in translating it, put things into his own words and even frame some of the conceptual content in the book in the process of translating. I think that that's a perfectly viable option for somebody who wants to remain a faithful Mormon and a believer in the historicity of the Book of Mormon, and yet also sees the power of John's argument. So,
yeah, I agree. All right. Thanks, everybody.